Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And in this episode, it's going to be all interview. I promise next week we'll get back to wine advice, tips, things like that. I'll give you a recommendation and other ways you can be a wine expert slash snob without knowing anything about wine. But this interview goes long and it deserves it. It's with Bruce Wallner, one of five Canadian Master Somms. We did the interview from the Wine Academy in downtown Toronto, one of the smartest guys when it comes to the smartest people when it comes to wine. Incredibly accomplished. This was a really fun, educational interview. We talk about his journey to becoming a Master Somm, what's going on in the world of wine, and he takes you through just what happens for the Quartermaster Sommelier in terms of when you do a tasting for a wine. So he breaks down this really tasty Bordeaux Blanc. Anyway, enjoy. It's a fantastic interview. Thanks so much for listening. And again, remember, you can subscribe iTunes, on Stitcher, and of course on Audioboom. So without further ado, here is Bruce Wallner. Hey everybody, welcome to the third edition of Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Yep, I'm staying with the name. A lot of people complaining, a lot of people want a different name. But this is my podcast. It starts with my name. It starts with Matt. So I am sticking with this title unless I get a sponsor who asks me to change it. And as you know, money talks, I would change in a heartbeat. Joining me now, and for the third podcast, I'm really sort of jumping in terms of big time guest, one of only three Master Somms in Canada. It is Bruce Wallner. Bruce, thank you so much for doing the podcast.
Great to be here. I think that name's kind of catchy. Rolls off the tongue.
Thank you. Thank you. Exactly. Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People. I guarantee by the end of it, you'll have no idea what the name of this podcast is. See, my last name is Cause. So someone said you should call it Cause I Love Wine. I'm like, I did not want to go with a clever pun. Everyone does clever puns for wine podcasts. So I'm like, no, I'm not doing I'll drink to that. That's Livy Dalton. I'll not do all these other ones. I'm going to go with long and clunky. I will die on that hill.
Fine. It is what it is. It's all there in the title.
Yeah, exactly. It explains everything.
I do have to say one thing off the start. You said 3 MSs in Canada. Not the case anymore.
Has there been an update since the last one? Because you and Bruce and Jennifer Huther, is there?
Me and
John Szabo, yeah. and
yeah, and so we're all based here in Toronto. And,
yeah,
yeah. We were. It was just the three of us for a long time, and then Elise Lambert. Oh. Who operates out of Montreal,
yeah.
Joined in. And then Pierre Alexis.
Oh, that's right.
Came along. Pierre Alexis Soulier, mm-hmm. And he is in Quebec City.
Yeah.
He's actually competing for the World Championship very soon. Just a few months, I think. So that's pretty exciting stuff. And in fact, we're on the verge of having a sixth. In fact, he had sort of passed all the areas, and now there's a little bit of a question of is he fully passed, is he not? But whatever the case is, mm-hmm. within a year he'll be fully passed. He's a super strong candidate. That's Steve Robinson from Ottawa.
Okay, is that from not Atelier? I'm trying to think of the name of from Atelier. And people who also want to know, I'm going to get into it a little bit later. Founder and director of the Somm Factory here in Toronto. I will say this: I love the overall approach, which is minimum in bricks and mortar, maximum in terms of buying and having great wines for people to try. And I want to talk about that in a little bit with you, the state of the industry. But to me, the place I'd like to start is just your own journey. And was there a moment, was there a bottle that, you know, you didn't decide, okay, I must work in wine my entire life, but at the very least, I need to learn more about what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very natural progression for me because, like so many young people, I was working in restaurants, and then I started bartending because I thought, you know, to be perfectly honest, I liked the way the bar separated me from the guests, and then give you a little bit more control of the situation. But I wanted to keep progressing in the same industry, and it seemed like the most respectable way to do it was to become a sommelier. Geez, it was so many years ago now, but. That it seemed like the right thing to do. Is there a great bottle that sent me down that path? Not really, but I did have a strange revelation when I was working in Vancouver for a group of restaurants called Umberto or Umberto's. A guy named Umberto Mengi. He still has restaurants out there. And you know what? It was amazing. I sort of stumbled into this role, and the legend is that no one ever works for Umberto for too long. And so the people who were buying wine ahead of me, were no longer with the company in fairly short order. And I just had a lot of wine buying responsibility dropped on my lap. So I started doing this job, and I was loving the job. And I was drinking a lot of wine. I just wasn't sure if I actually liked wine.
Right? Really?
So at one point I was like, am I faking this? What's going on? Am I going through the paces? Am I going, like I really felt like, I don't know. Like,
how old were you around this point? Just to put it in context. And again, you could be off by a couple of years, either north or south.
Yeah, I don't. I guess I was 22, 23, 24, in there.
Yep.
Somewhere in there. And I was having a great time. But I definitely preferred beer to wine.
Mm-hmm.
That's without a doubt. Probably preferred spirits to both of them. And I kept going through these. But the big problem is this. You read about all these out-of-body experiences that people have with wine.
Yeah.
And you know, how their soul was touched and how it tasted like something from another planet. And you're like, oh, fuck, I'm not having those experiences.
Yeah, where's my moment?
And and particularly with champagne, I was like, I just find champagne annoying. I don't. And I did have a Christmas where I enjoyed a bottle. You know what? It was a bottle of 1979 Krug Clos de Meny. Actually, a very historically significant wine. A wine that I don't know would be approaching priceless at this point. I didn't have any idea what it was, though, so I just drank it from the bottle. And
you drank it from the bottle?
Yeah, well, with a couple of friends.
Okay. Hold on, you undid the cork and just passed the bottle around?
Yeah, I did. And well, I'll tell you where our mindset was at that time. We thought, like, wouldn't it be fun to be bald? So we shaved our heads, like completely bald, like Kojak. And then we sat around on a Christmas morning, we drank this bottle of champagne from the bottle. Just had a good old time.
By the way, anyone under 30, Google Kojak, and joke by Bruce will make a lot more sense.
Sorry, like completely bald, not just a closely trimmed, completely bald. And strange experience. But in any case, this champagne was so delicious. It was just a delicious beverage that happened to have bubbles. I was like, oh, wait a second. I think I finally get this.
Yeah.
Like now I'm having one of those experiences. This is great.
Yeah. Now I get to join in with all the other stories.
Yeah. I mean, wine wasn't just to get smashed on anymore. It was something that was a bit more exciting. It was pretty late. Like I was already, you know, I was already doing the role.
Yeah.
I was already doing the sommelier role at that point. And then a little later on, I had no certification at the time, right? As a lot of people working in wine end up with, and I didn't see the need for it. And then I finally said, well, I guess I should do this. If I'm going to do it, I guess I should really do it. And I went down that path, which was great because then I got to see the gaping holes in my knowledge, right? So a sensible thing to do.
Yeah, mine, as I said in the first episode, was a brick orange bottle of Barolo. I knew nothing about this wine. I didn't know where it was. It was a friend of my stepdad's brought it over, poured me a glass. I'm like, ooh, gross. That's not what wine looks like. I took a sip, and I got goosebumps, and I started laughing because it was so good. I'm like, what the hell is going on in my mouth? And then I wanted to pour the glass right up to the edge and go, just everyone stay away from me. Me and this glass are going to hang out together for the next little while.
Yeah, and that, you know what? That the great thing is that does happen sometimes.
Yeah.
Right? Of course, you know, the people never do leave because then they want to drink your Barolo. That's the sad part.
That is true. You try to give them the Dolcetto, but they're like, no, we're going to go over there. I was reading on you because I try to do as much research as I can. You were the first non-French individual. You were the head somm for Chateau de Vin in the United Kingdom.
Yeah. There was a group of hotels called Hotel de Vin.
Hotel de Vin.
And it was started.
Yeah, not Chateau, excuse me, hotel. Yeah.
It was started by what is still the most remarkable sommelier, I think, to walk this planet, Gerard Basset. An incredible man who became a master sommelier, became a master of wine, picked up an MBA on the way and the business of wine.
Wow. He doesn't sleep much, or he didn't sleep much.
Yeah, I think he's got the Order of the British Empire, an OBE. He also became the Meilleur Sommelier du Monde, which is a massive, massive competition that people train their whole lives for. The guy was it's insane how accomplished he is. But the most amazing thing is, it's incredible how humble he is.
Mm-hmm.
He's the kind of guy that you know, if you say it to another sommelier, we all use him as a reference point to look and say like, well, that's a guy I want to be. Like, I want to be a little bit more like him.
Yeah.
You know, in your professional life, you're always like, I got to keep trying to be a little bit more like Gerard Bessé, understanding that I'm never going to be there, but I'm going to keep trying. But he had founded this group of hotels based on wine.
Yeah.
Hotel de Vin. And of course, look, he thinks of himself as British now, but he was French born in town Saint-Étienne. And so all the sommeliers working were French. I happened to be the first non-French sommelier to step into the head role, the chef sommelier for was their biggest hotel at the time.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about. Was there any sort of prejudice about, because, you know, especially for more traditionalists, you know, maybe a little more closed-minded, it's like, okay, wine, France, and what is a Canadian doing telling me about Saint-Estèphe?
I don't know. Like,
did you have to deal with any of that?
Not from Gerard. Certainly not from Gerard.
Yeah.
But, I mean, are you asking me if French people are racist?
I am asking you if our wine people, you know, were looking at the Canadian
I took a beating every single day.
Yeah.
Every single day.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It was like I really learned by shame. Absolutely phenomenal, and I got a lot of free reign, and in other ways, it was just a constant beat down.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. Like, maybe not the best learning environment for all people, but for me, it really worked well. But it was really the old school way of learning the trade.
Yeah. And well, you said before about just humility, about your mentor and about when you meet him, just there's so much humility, and that is wine. And because, you know, just when you think you learn it all, we were talking before we went on about what was going on with winemaking practices, you know, for recent vintages of white Burgundy. And there's always so much knowledge, and just, you know, and then if you spend a month where you're not studying, you're going to forget, you know, some mountain ranges in Priorat. Like, this, it is such a humbling business because of so much that you need to learn and be on top of.
Well, every vintage is a brand new year, right?
Yeah.
Like there's quite literally. It's constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no standing still. You know, there's always. It's interesting in a way because every now and then you meet some people who are usually people who are a little bit interested in wine, and they're very much into sort of wine one-upmanship, and it's a bit of a goofy game because you can make anyone feel the fool with wine, right? So it's not there's not much point to the game when it's very easy to do, right? Yeah, we try not to do that. We try to be a little bit more listening and less ridicule.
All right, I want to continue on the theme of humbling, but also on the line of triumph. And it's because I've been to a lot of the wine competitions, and you know, I talked about this in my first one when I went for the certified, past tasting, past theory, but I've never worked in restaurants. So when I did my service, I placed the glass, the first flute down, on the wrong side. So then I decided I had to be consistent. So I put it on the wrong side for everyone at the table. And then as I was pouring, my arm had to go right in the eyes of the judge. So then my hand starts shaking. And the glass, as I said, was like Niagara Falls. It was like a torrent of you know, it was probably Prosecco, on both the inside and the outside of the glass. A spectacular failure. As I'm pouring, I'm like, well, I just failed all of this. So, you know, I've certainly been on that end of it. But I'm curious for you, because I know you've won Best Somm of Ontario, I think back in 2012.
Yeah.
Just your best moments. And I'd love to hear it, one story or two, a failure and of success when, you know, you nailed that Beaujolais, or, you know, you screwed up somewhere else. Because, you know, I think people listening, especially when they recognize just your level in the wine world, that, yeah, sometimes you achieve greatness and, wow, sometimes you flame out.
Yeah. Yeah, for certain. Well, that was a pretty good competition, actually.
The 2000, and if you want to talk about that back, you know, that competition, because I went back and looked at it, and some of the people that came in second, third, and fourth, you're like, I know that person. Like, okay, that person's ahead of this. That person's doing this. Like, almost everyone in that competition, you know, achieved a level of success.
Yeah, a great group of competitors for sure. But we have a great group of sommeliers in Ontario, right? You know, I think I prepared reasonably well for that, and on the day we were a little bit relaxed, right? There's a break in between the morning sessions where you do the theory and a little bit of blind tasting, and then they announce the finalists in the afternoon, so you have a break. So
yeah,
I went home, had lunch, drank some champagne.
And, yeah.
Got
yourself ready for service.
Well, we were with another guy who's actually an unbelievable sommelier. And I won't mention his name because we went and he said, well, where are you going? I said, I'm going to go home for lunch and have something nice. And I said, well, why don't you come with me? And we get there and he said, well, what if I make the finals? I don't really know what they're expecting as far as the correct competition style service. I was like, well, why don't we practice with a bottle of champagne right now?
Really?
So that's what we did. We played around. He did the service for me. We kind of did a little impromptu training for one of the other competitors.
That's very nice of you. Very altruistic of you.
Oh, very nice of me to sit around, have lunch, and drink some champagne.
That's
yeah,
true.
Sure. I'm big that way.
Yeah. Hey, could you tell people, because the tricky thing with this podcast and what I want to do is try to strike the right tone in terms of information and all that for some people listening to this are probably the more hardcore. And then there's going to be some of the wine enthusiasts or people that are just getting into wine. And actually, yeah. I want to talk about those people and how it relates to the Somm Factory in a little bit. But for people who don't know, just what is it like when you're in these top level competitions in terms of what you are asked to do?
Oh, you know, nothing insane. They only what you would normally be asked to do in a restaurant, mm-hmm. which, okay, is a little bit insane sometimes. So they ask you some funny little tasks and a lot of questions at the table. And can you pair some wines to this menu? And I think in that competition they said, oh, well, actually, we only want Canadian wines for this. And actually, can you recommend Canadian cheeses? And I was like, oh, I don't know if I can do that, but all right, let's give it a shot.
Yeah.
And then it's a very funny situation because you're in front of a big crowd and you're serving tables. But you're not really serving tables, right? You're serving judges. And if you can keep in your mind that, look, I'm just going to look after these guests, it tends to go well. But it's still very nerve-wracking. And then they roll out a little trolley, and on it they have some glasses that you don't know what they are. They're blind beverages,
yeah.
Right? There's a couple of wines and a couple of spirits and things. And I actually got to see myself doing it. Somebody filmed it, and I got a chance to look at it. And I was hilarious. Oh, it was comical, right? Because you know, there's a certain way to approach it. Of course, you do your full tasting note on your wines first, and then you go and taste the spirits. But there's not much point in tasting a spirit and then going back and trying to pick up on nuances on wine afterwards.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
But you can see I'm exactly doing that. I've got this wine or this spirit. I can't quite figure it out because it seems like there's a rawness to it, and it seems like a distillate, a fruit-based distillate. But it's brown. So it's clearly had time in oak. I'm like, well, I don't understand what kind of, it seems sort of raw and almost harsh. And yet it's oak aged. I got no, it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
Like this is grappa, but okay, well, it doesn't make sense, but I'm going to say it's an oak aged grappa, which you have. It's just not a regular product.
No.
Right? You normally see grappa being water white.
Yeah.
So that's your expectation. So whatever, I'm doing that, and then now I'm going to taste my white wine. Well, what am I doing? I was jumping all over the place. It was hilarious. It was an absolute disaster. Well, it wasn't a disaster in that I got the wines correct, but my mechanics were shameful.
Do you remember what the wines were?
No idea.
I always wonder about that because it's the same thing. Like you can ask a pitcher about a pitch sequence where they struck out someone in a playoff game from 12 years ago, and so many pitchers can go, "Well, I started curve, and then you know I got him chasing."
Oh man!
And I ask you because if you're at your level, your recall for being able to tell, you know, producers from this area, like just the amount of stuff, information crammed in your head is at a ridiculous level. So I wondered if you knew it. Do you remember your best?
I think it's a little different in that the pitcher's probably still in control of that game.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, that's a good
Whereas
point.
I think the competitor, I'm not sure if he's in control at that point. You know, right at the end of his service, he's probably just wants to go in a corner and cry a little bit.
Do you remember a wine tasting? And if you don't, it's fine. I got 4 billion questions. I won't get to all of them. But one, maybe even when you're younger, when you nailed it and you felt really good about it. Or one where you're like, I can't believe I called blank blank. Because I'm always curious about Psalm's success and moments of failure.
Yeah. I mean, there's an old quote, and I think it's from... I think it's from Michael Broadbent, this English, this sort of legendary English wine writer. And they said, well, have you ever confused Bordeaux for Burgundy?
Yeah.
And he said, well, not since lunch. But it's very true. You know, you get things wrong all the time.
Yeah.
Look, I was just gridding a flight for a candidate this morning, and I went through and I was, you know, sure I knew what this wine was. And, well, I'll tell you, I called it Barolo. And I was like, I mean, it has all this dried fruit and, you know, and then tans are a little bit harsh. For sure it's Barolo. And I looked at the color. Everything's making sense for me. There's no question at all. This is Barolo. I guarantee, my friend. and then I went and checked and I was like, oh, well, what do you know? It turned out to be a Burgundy, but that Burgundy had been opened the day before. So
right.
A little bit of dried fruit. So whatever it was, I shat the bed.
Yeah.
So that's okay. I just then traded it out and put a Barolo in the lineup because I was so angry at that bottle. But no, it happens. Like we often do flights of six, and I can't remember a time when I've gotten all six of them correct.
Yeah.
And sometimes that happens, but you're like, well, okay, that's not even realistic, right? Like every now and then that's the deal. But what you really hope for with blind tasting is that you run through it in a systematic fashion and you define what's in the glass. That's what you're hoping for. To actually guess the vintage and the producer and the winemaker's dog's name, you know, that's not really that important. What's important is that you define what's in the glass and you communicate what's in the glass. And, you know, as long as you're doing that, I think it's okay. In the end, you take a wrong turn, and well, so what?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. On your bio...
If you're super concerned with taking that wrong turn and getting wines wrong,
then get out.
Oof, yeah, you gotta choose another field.
Oh yeah,
you gotta choose another field.
It's like a little bit later on. I'm gonna have Bruce do a tasting, and I showed you the bottle. Yeah. And if you enjoy the podcast this time, and if you agree to come back somewhere down the road, I'll do some blind with you, and not some sort of regional funky thing from Portugal. But man, blind tasting, especially early on, the insecurity. Even I remember at the diploma level for WSET, you know, there were still moments of just who wants to go first and say what this wine is, and there's still that moment of God, I don't want to make an ass of myself. You go first. Like that insecurity is still there, even among, you know, really talented, hardworking people.
Yeah. Well, sure. It's a funny position to be in, right? And you're really put on the spot. Look, I'm delighted to make an ass of myself. So
yeah.
So no problem. We'll do blind tasting whenever you want.
Yeah. All right. Fantastic. On your bio, it says, you know, when it says the wines you like to drink, the first one it says is Riesling. Yeah. And it's something that ever since I started to start taking courses in wine years and years ago, I started to fall in love with Riesling, and everyone within the wine industry always loves Riesling, and they always proclaim, this is the year where Riesling is going to finally become the it white wine. And then every year, Riesling is not among, you know, the general public. What is it about Riesling? Why, explain to people that are just new or just learning about wine, why they need to put down the Italian Pinot Grigio and get themselves something from Moselle.
I don't think anyone needs to do that.
What they need to drink all that Pinot Grigio, then get themselves some Riesling that they may normally not drink.
Well, Pinot Grigio plays an important role in supporting the economy in Veneto. Like it's
yes, it
you
is.
Know, you don't want to give that up. That and Prosecco. There's a couple of ordinary wines that pay a lot of bills. I think it's fine. You want to drink Pinot Grigio, drink Pinot Grigio.
I'm not sitting here to shame the Pinot Grigio drinkers. I find a lot of it is liquid cold, that is basically lemon, lime, and alcohol. Yeah. But I'm not here to rip it, and you're right, economically it plays a big part, but I want you to sell Riesling.
No way. Because I'm happy to drink Riesling. It's fantastic. I think Why do I love Riesling? I honestly don't mind if no one else gets excited about Riesling. Because the thing is, your only concern would be that people stop growing it.
Yeah. Right?
But winemakers get excited about it. Growers get excited about Riesling. So that's never going to happen, right? Even if you have a winery that looks at the Riesling and is like, wow, nobody ever wants this. Nobody's ever going to pay $35 for this. But maybe Riesling for Canadian producers anyway seems to top out around $30. It's tough to get more than that.
Yeah.
But, you know,
Two Sisters. But, they do a more expensive Riesling.
But oh yeah.
Beyond. Yeah. Yeah. They got one that's mid to late 30s. It's a little bit older. They released it a couple years older, and yeah. That's the only, off the top of my head, it's the only one I can think of.
Yeah.
That's breaking $30. And there's lots of good, well priced Riesling. I think Featherstone, their Black Sheep Riesling, really tasty for like just under $17.
Yeah, or Cave Spring.
Yeah.
Across the board. Actually, when I think about it, I wonder what Charles Baker. The Pecone Vineyard is at right now.
$35, $38? Yeah, yeah. The higher end, single vineyard stuff. That's got to be over 30.
That's a great wine though.
I think.
That's one of Canada's best wines consistently year in year out. And so why isn't it $80? Right, and then you can have a very run of the mill ordinary Cabernet Merlot blend that's just basically a half decent red wine.
Yeah.
With no distinction to it at all, and that's $55. That seems strange to me, but I don't mind, right?
Yeah.
Because of the amount of Riesling I drink, I'd prefer to have it lower priced. So that's fantastic.
I don't disagree. I was having some for lunch today. Early lunch.
I tell you what I think is what's magic about Riesling is that look, it doesn't need a lot of bells and whistles from the winery to taste great, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You don't need a signature of oak. You don't need to go through malolactic conversion. You don't need extended lees contact, but and then maybe a little bit of lees contact is nice. But whatever it is, you don't need to add something to that wine to make it taste great. It just tastes great already, right? And in a range of styles, you could have totally dry. You could have a little bit of residual sugar, and actually, it's the ones with a bit of residual sugar that delight me the most, right? And maybe that's a reason that people don't jump on it, because as soon as they taste that bit of residual sugar, like, oh, wait, this is cheap wine.
Yeah.
I remember when I drank wine with residual sugar.
It's the blue.
It was called Mad Dog 2020, and it wasn't good wine, right? So you make that immediate association, or Blue Nun, or Black Tower, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You get the PTSD on the goopy sweet stuff from back in the day.
No, for sure. And so I think people are just a little hesitant to embrace residual sugar wines again, which is strange because for red wines, residual sugar reds. As long as nobody calls them sweet.
Yeah.
As long as we pretend they're dry.
Oh, yeah.
But you can leave 17 grams of residual sugar.
Yeah.
And that's the most popular wine on the shelves. That's amazing. Like, we all talk dry and drink sweet, right? So I think that's a base problem with Riesling, is there's a thought that, oh, it's Riesling, it must have residual sugar. Obviously not the case all the time, but I think that scares some people off. But one of the great things about it, one of the things that I love about it so much, though, is that it kind of lets the, I'll use a cliche term and say, it lets the vineyard shine through.
Mm-hmm.
So what, does that mean you taste the rocks from the vineyard? Not really, but it does mean that you treat Riesling exactly the same way in two different plots of land, and it tastes totally different. Different parts of the world tasting totally different.
Yeah.
Different regions within one country tasting totally different, right? It's kind of remarkable that way.
Yeah.
Right? The different expressions you can get out. It's a delight. And that's why you drink wine in the end, right?
It is. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, for these little subtle differences and sometimes not so subtle differences, right? If you want something that tastes the same all the time, well, then you should probably drink gin and tonics.
Yeah.
Because those taste good.
They do taste good. And you know what you're going to get. There's a bunch of stuff I want to get in the Somme Factory, but you were doing an interview recently with Jamie Drummond talking a lot about the Somme Factory, but you had one quote right in the middle of it all, and it sort of might have got lost, but I was going through the interview yesterday. You mentioned how you weren't making much money working as a somm on the floor. Can you help to dispel the myth? Because people are like, oh, you work in wine. And then they go, ooh la la. I'm like, no, though they get to drink crazy good wines. So sometimes they get to go to cool every now and then. If they're really, really lucky, they get flown somewhere neat in Europe. But it's not as glamorous a job as people might think.
No, there's a lot of boxes to carry and cellars to clean and bottles to put away and inventory to do and pricing, and there's a, you know, there's a lot of ordinary stuff. I mean, for us, Matt, I clean a lot of spittoons.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's not exactly a glamorous job.
No, no, it's not. See, no one, that's great. No one thinks about that part. They just think you're sitting there drinking Lafitte, you know, explaining what 1982 was all about. The spittoon washing. That's the other part.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a real pleasure.
Yeah, that, and is that true, like, just in terms of you weren't making just, like, the money is, I guess the money is not as great for Psalms as I think people that don't know. They probably have a higher price point in their head.
Look, it's like this. In restaurants in general, there's a real limit to what people are willing to pay, right?
Yeah.
And especially if we're looking at Ontario, we've kept our wine as sort of a support for the restaurant, you know, and we want to put as little effort as possible into selling that wine for three times the price of what we bought it for, right? But there is some effort, right? You have to have nice glassware, and
yep.
And you still have to do, you still have to have proper linen, well, depending on where you're at, I guess. And then you have to store the wine, and then you have to serve it correctly. And, you know, if it needs to be decanted, it's got to be decanted. And there's costs associated with all of this, right? So is it bad to charge three times as much? I don't know. Maybe we could charge a little bit less. But the big problem is we don't charge enough for food.
Yeah.
Right? Hmm. There's a real ceiling of what people want to pay for a dish, and it becomes a little bit ridiculous. So how do you have a viable restaurant, right? Like, everyone wants to look after the staff properly. Everyone wants to create a great experience for their guests. And in the end, you're looking at this tiny little margin that you're working on. So at what point do you then say, okay, we're going to pay our sommelier $8? Well, those dollars aren't there.
Yeah.
Right? And it's, I appreciate that with the system we have, in that there's no wholesale price for wine, right? So the system that everyone sees, or the price that everyone sees on the LCBO shelves, well, that's the same price as the restaurant is paying.
Yeah.
You don't get a special discount, right? So you know exactly what the markup is. You're like, yeah, I just saw that on the shelf for $20. Here it is for $60. Well, maybe that's unfair. Sure, it's unfair. But then, you know, it costs $23 to put that dish in front of you, and you're only willing to pay $26.
Yeah.
So, you know, it has to be a balance, right? And the truth is that's the wine programs tend to take the hit on that, tend to provide the revenue, and then they don't get the dollars out of it. But no one in a restaurant is getting the dollars out of it, quite honestly. So it is what it is. It's a beautiful, beautiful industry where you look after people and make people happy every day. You don't get paid for it.
Yeah, right? That's a great way of putting it. Psalm Factory, from everything I read, it started with you with one study group with three people, and now it's, you know, it's turning into a real, I don't want to say cottage industry, that almost seems like an insult, but it's it's turning into just this go-to place for people that want to learn about wine. I'm just, the motivations for starting Psalm Factory, where is it now, and where would you like to see it in 2020? And by the way, I just did the worst interviewing technique. I asked you three questions in one, so let's bang them out one at a time. The genesis behind it.
Well, I was teaching already.
Yeah.
I was teaching a bit at George Brown and very much enjoying that experience. And, you know, I'd recommend George Brown to anyone. But it was, you know, the classes were of a certain size and you know, around 20 to 25 people. Not huge by any measure, but I didn't feel like I could really see everyone, look everyone in the eye, really communicate with everyone properly. I wanted a more intimate experience, and so we started out with a quite intimate experience with three people, just as you say, and we started working on that. We took a lot of the techniques we had used for training people for Master Sommelier exams and for world competitions, and we used a lot of that and just said, well, let's apply it here and see how it works. See how effectively we can learn when you have that direct communication, right? As opposed to sort of sitting in a lecture. Instead, you have this interactive, real intimate setting, and how much more effective can we make the learning? And we found that it was night and day,
yeah. Right?
So we found that we could really get people from a base level to a certified sommelier level super efficiently.
Could you correct my the shaking in my hand?
We can fix that. Yeah. No problem.
Yeah.
No problem at all.
By the way, at some point, I need to get my bleep in certified. Like it just.
I thought you already had it. Quite honestly.
No, I got the. I haven't gone back. Just life and work and other things got in the way.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's something that I'd say once every 2 weeks. I'm just, you know, I just sit there and just sort of like just give a little, damn it, you know, and just there's always a little bit of that.
Yeah, we can help you with that. That's
yeah.
No problem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But sorry, continue.
We moved from there and that's expanded a little bit. I mean, three people was never going to be the plan going forward.
Yeah.
We thought maybe eight was the right number. And now we're a little bit more, 12 to 15 is our ideal number.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to go beyond that. That's what we want to stay at. And it's the right number. I can communicate with a group of 18 people very, very clearly. But if I go beyond that, it's too much, right? And like you were mentioning earlier, we have a lovely advantage in that we share our space with the restaurant Thoroughbred.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a restaurant that's going through some changes right now. They have just over a week to go as Thoroughbred. And then there's going to be, I don't know how much of this information is released, but it's going to be a vegan pop-up for 3 months.
Yep.
And then after that, we're going to do something fun and interesting with it.
Cool. And by the way, it's on 304 Richmond West.
Yeah.
I don't mind you're giving your time. I don't mind giving plugs whatsoever.
Yeah. No, it's a great restaurant.
Yeah.
And a restaurant, I mean, my only involvement was to train their staff a bit and do their wine list and hang out there all the time.
Yeah.
Well, we're becoming a little bit more involved in it. And that's going to be pretty exciting. But in the meantime, we're sharing the space and you end up in the space that's comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And as you alluded to, not nearly as expensive as, you know, having a gigantic institutional sort of...
Yeah, bricks and mortar.
Yeah. So it's been ideal for us.
Yeah. Right?
And to have that connection with the food where we can always, you know, we can always bring that into the classroom. And, you know, if students want to, they would go for a snack beforehand or after. Just it makes sense for the wine, right?
Yeah.
So we really get down to it. We have an environment where instead of just memorizing appellations, we're understanding wine.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah, part of that is enjoying wine.
I pride myself on my Twitter, more on my Twitter account. I'm trying to do this more with Instagram, where I send out douchebag shots, you know, like sunset at my cottage on a boat with a glass. And it's all done on purpose, where I want people to go, screw you, cause. And then they send me pictures of them in Venice. And they're like, beat this cause with my D. And I love it because it means they're somewhere beautiful and they're wonderful. And I'm like, good, you beat me. And I'm happy for that. But I'm damn good at the D-bag shot. But your Instagram account, and you're not being a douchebag, but I look at your Instagram account when you're showing the wines you are pouring for the Somme Factory. I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, this celebrity wine. I know, like, it's like a red carpet of vino. Good for you for the investment you do in the wine that you get to expose these students, because some of it's ridiculous.
Yeah, well, I mean, we get to try the wines too, right?
Yeah.
So, I know. So no. It's all without selfish motivation.
Oh, no. I understand that. I'm just saying that your Instagram account makes me jealous when I see it.
Yeah. That's funny. I've been neglecting it lately because we've had so much going on. And actually, one of our lead teacher, Samuel de la Noche, was going for a competition down in Mexico City. So he's gone for a couple of weeks. And so for a couple of weeks, my Instagram was non-existent. So I got to get back on it. You're sort of guilting me into it now.
I'm sorry.
I got to leave this interview now and work on my Instagram. I'm sorry.
Oh, we got so much more. How different of a teacher are you now versus when you started? And I'm not talking Somme Factory, but even before, just mentoring people. Like, how different would you say you are?
Very different.
Yeah.
Very different. I mean, I came from a background where there was, you know, I mentioned before the learning by shame. And, and you know, I of course, you carry some of that forward, and you're a little bit... I'm less of a dickhead now than I used to be.
Yeah.
I'll say that. I listen to students more than I used to, that's for sure. I mean, I hope I'm hoping the teaching is more effective.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what, it helps too now that we have Sam in there that does a lot of, and he does a lot of classes. So it's great to see his technique and how he approaches things and how he relates to students. But I guess it's gone a little bit from a lecture style to something that used to be, here's how it is.
Yeah.
Now listen up. Here's how it is.
Yeah.
To something a little bit almost conversational. We're like, well, I don't know. I can't give you a definitive call on wine, certainly not a definitive judgment on wine. We got to open up and you know, try everything with an open mind and listen to other people's preferences. And you know, people like all kinds of wines.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to be very much like, look, that wine's good, that wine's not good.
Yeah.
And I still feel that personally, but... You know, if someone comes to me and says, no, I love reds with residual sugar, that's fine.
Great. If you love that's on you.
Nothing wrong with that at all.
Except if it's fusion, then you're wrong.
That is a funny wine. There's a great example of some RS in a red wine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Bizarre stuff. But not for me. Like, I don't want to drink it, but why would I have a problem with someone else drinking that? Like your Pinot Grigio mentioned earlier, like, oh, well, it's not the most interesting wine in the world for me. Unless you get a great Pinot Grigio, but those are few and far between.
Well, it's not that there's not great stuff. It's just what we're exposed to here in Southern Ontario. It's not that it's not out there. It's just, you know, what we get is just, there's not stuff with a lot of depth. A lot of it just seems to taste the same. And maybe it's because my mom, I think single-handedly, and I would say this to her face, I've joked to her, she's helping keeping Veneto alive, just and all the Frulli on her own, just, you know, the amount. And she drinks almost the same Pinot Grigio all the time. And she loves it. It's great. And she's like, do you want a glass? I'm like, do we have, because I'm just sort of tired with them. Like, do we have anything else? Can I put a little Sprite in it? Let me do something.
Yeah, a little ginger ale, squeeze a lemon.
Sure, exactly. just you know, gin it up a little bit. Before we go to the blind tasting, and I got so many more questions, but some stuff I'm going to say for hopefully, you know, I'd love to chat with you again, and also I get guilty about taking up too much of someone's time. I would imagine for Somm Factory to, you know, really grow, you're going to want more people that aren't just industry and people that aren't, you know, that aren't studying for their, you know, for their advanced. What would you say, like, just your sales pitch to people to come to Somm? Like, a lot of people listening are people that sometimes get intimidated by wine, which part of what this podcast is about is to try to get rid of all that intimidation. Wine is fun. Explore. Try new stuff. If you love it, great. If you hate it, don't worry. There's plenty more around the corner. But just for people that want to come to Somm Factory to learn a little bit more, to understand what it is they're drinking, what would be your pitch?
Oh, wow. I mean, I don't have a pitch, but what I think is nice about coming as a, now I'll use a terrible term here, coming in as a civilian,
yeah,
which is an old school term we used to use for, you know, people working in restaurants were in the industry and then everyone else was a civilian.
Yeah.
So if you're just an enthusiast, you enjoy drinking wine, you want to learn a little bit more, why would you go to Somm Factory? Well, it's comfortable,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, if you enjoy going to restaurants, sitting down and drinking wine, well, that's what we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, it's I would say it's the least intimidating environment in the world. I think, as far as I know, it's the least intimidating wine environment in the world, which I guess we pride ourselves on that quite a bit, because it's also an environment where the instructors are extraordinarily well informed. Right?
Yeah.
Well, we have textbooks we use, but we wrote the textbooks.
Yeah.
Right. So, and not just myself, but together with Sam. So the guy that's teaching the class is intimately familiar with the content, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it makes things just so much more comfortable.
Yeah,
you don't get somebody reading from cue cards. You get someone who's just going to chat with you, and it works. It works brilliantly well. We probably dropped below 50% industry, I don't know, close to a year ago.
Oh, fantastic.
And it keeps developing that way. Well, I mean, there is a finite of people in the restaurant industry. And you go to restaurants now, and it seems like all Somm Factory students. So I think we're running out.
Oh, that's great. I think it's awesome. And it's, you know, on a much smaller level than what you're doing. That's why I want to do this podcast is, so you're not intimidated at the LCBO or when you're at that restaurant and it's like Gandalf's wizard book, you know, some of the wine menus and you don't know what to order. And I tell people all the time, tweet me or text me when you're at the LCBO. If I can help you out, you know, anything I can do to help, I will. Because this is fun.
Yeah. And
in the end, that's what wine is supposed to be. It's supposed to be enjoyable and fun.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So I want people to hear it because when I was studying for diploma and all these things, I would listen to every wine podcast. And I was such a nerd. I would re-listen to different people in the industry doing wine tastings. You know, and I, you know, it ridiculous. I shouldn't have done that, but I love it. And I was wondering if you could just do. I don't know if you want the mic stand for it, or if you can do it with one hand and the mic in the other. I was wondering.
Yeah, that's fine.
Drinking a. Do you need a little?
Sure. Yeah, thanks.
A little more. This Bordeaux Blanc. I was wondering if you could. And again, much like you did on Wine Wire, I will. I will shut the hell up and let you just go through what would be considered sort of your tasting notes for the wine.
Okay, so we'll go through, I guess, what they call the grid, which is what you'd be expected to do in a certified exam, in a written style or in an advanced exam. You would do that verbally. And I would say that the big thing is that when you attack the wine in this way, you want to split it into three. How does it look? How does it smell? And how does it taste? And from those observations, you then go into a completely different segment of the tasting where you take those observations, say, well, let me look at all the evidence I've gathered here. What have I said? Right? And you don't think about what the wine is. Well, let's put it another way. You don't think about what's on the label as you're tasting it. You just think about what's in the glass. You make your observations, and then you stop and say, okay, based on those observations, what can I say about this wine? So let's try this. I'll give you a slightly concise version because it gets a little tedious. If it goes, it would take sort of a 3.5-4 minutes to go through the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah,
it's a bit much. But to look at this wine, it's actually a super attractive wine. It has a beautiful, brilliant gold color. It's totally clear. It's there's no sediment or CO2 in here. A little bit of definition to the rim. It looks kind of water white on the rim. And how does it smell? You know, it's still a bit closed on the nose, but it starts to express itself a little bit with kind of this dried herb. Maybe more important than anything else, it's sound, it's clean. I would say it's a medium minus intensity, and it smells like it's got a bit of age on it. Right. So what really jumps out? What's important here? Well, it's quiet, but it has loads of stuff going on. So there's this light toast to it. There's a little bit of sort of almost a sourdough bread thing to it. There's a strange greenness that it's a mix of dried herbs and like stewed grass. So it's a dried and a cooked greenness, but nothing that's just a super fresh, like cutting into a green bell pepper. Not like that straightforward freshness. Usually when we do this, we think of a couple other things. You think like, does it have any florality? Does it have any honey? Is there anything else that could be confectionery in here? Where's the earthiness? Where's the minerality? But let's stick to what's really important. What's really important here is that toast. There's a bit of creaminess to it, almost like a brown butter, and then that mix of dried herbs and ridiculous sounding stewed grass. So let's try it. Man, I love that wine. That's really cool. We should announce what the wine is in just a moment, but on the palate, you know, first it's dry. It sounds like something silly. You're like, oh, obviously it's dry. No, not so obvious. Let's talk about what residual sugar it has, and this has very little. So it's totally dry, and the acidity is really bright and fresh. I would say medium plus. Alcohol, I don't really notice it much. Like, there's not much warmth to this. I could say medium alcohol. What does that mean to me? Maybe it's 12.5, 13%. It could be up to 13.5. I don't know. My safest bet is 13, but... anything else we need to note here? Well, what's the body? I would say this is a medium plus body. There's a lot going on. And since I'm saying that, let's jump to a little bit out of order. What's the complexity here? Actually, there's lots of complexity because you have that real distinct toastiness that carries through to the palate, right? And then you have that, there is fruit here. I haven't mentioned much about fruit at all, but there's kind of almost a sweeter side of citrus, like a tangerine or mandarin. Kind of fruitiness. There's a little bit of stone fruit as well, a little bit of pomaceous fruit, almost like pear. And, you know, on the nose, it has a ripeness to it. And on the palate, you see this ripeness off the start, and then it quite tartens up quite a bit. Right? So, also quite an enjoyable wine. What else? That brown butter is still there. And what about that greenness, that herbaceousness? Yeah, it shows up on the palate again. cool. There's loads of stuff going on. And look, the key is that there's such different families, like that toast and a little bit of caramel too, and then the brown butter, and then that funny dried herb and fresher herb and cooked herb, and then a little bit of fruit to it as well. Like entirely different families, like all mixed together in a seamless way. So right now I'm quite impressed with this wine, right? How long is the finish? Let's say medium plus. Stays with you a while. Okay. So what do you draw from this? How do you make a conclusion on this? Well, you take a look at what your alcohol and your acid is, and I would say that our acid's slightly elevated on this, and our alcohol is around the, you know, close to the middle, maybe just slightly elevated. And so what does that mean? Well, I guess the most sensible thing is to call that moderate climate, in that they're both just a little bit elevated. All right. And then, well, do you think it's old world or new world? Well, on the palate, it has this freshness, this tartness, that it's almost a little tiny bit shocking. You're like, whoa, it's not pure pleasure when you first try it. It actually, it's a little tiny bit challenging, right? Like that's a real kind of old world signature. You know, if it was made in the new world, they would just make it so friendly, so everyone just absolutely loved it. Because what's the object in the new world? The object is to sell bottles of wine. What's the object in the old world? Sure, they love to sell wine, but also they're restricted. They're restricted by tradition. They're restricted by what their parents and grandparents did. And also, they're restricted by law. You can only have, I think, on this appellation, I think it's 3 grams per liter residual sugar. But in any case, you can't have a wine that shows a little bit sweet. Right? So, well, obviously, if this was the same wine was from California, you could have that little flattering sweetness to it, right? So it has that real freshness, that tartness. And what else do you want to say about this wine? Well, now, do we think, well, what could our grapes be here? And, well, what's really our big flag? Well, you see that there's winemaking because you see that toastiness and you see that kind of breadiness, like fresh baked bread. So there's a little action in the winery. And, okay, so what does that make sense? I don't know. Chardonnay is a pretty good call on that, right? But then there's that distinct greenness, right? And the weird greenness because it's somehow cooked and dried at the same time. And that's how Sauvignon Blanc gets when it goes in a barrel. It gets this funny, like the greenness changes. It changes from something fresh to something cooked. And it's so, so, so distinctive. In the end, like what we should be finding in here, but it's not, I don't find it. But we should be finding a waxiness as well, some sort of viscosity to this wine that kind of reminds you of chewing on wax, which is kind of a signature of the Semillon. I think it's half Semillon, half Sauvignon Blanc. And I don't notice that, right? Like, I find it really hard to pinpoint that the Semillon in here. But I guess there's a bit of broadness to the palate, which I would credit to that. In the end, the wine is a super unique wine because it's from Chateau Giraud, which is a great Sauternes producer. But this is not Sauternes. This is Bordeaux Blanc. So Sauternes sits in Graves, where the best Bordeaux Blanc is made. And it's just sometimes they don't want to just make sweet wine. Well, Sauternes has to be sweet, right? Sometimes they want to make a totally dry wine. So they don't label it Sauternes. They label it Bordeaux Blanc. It's actually a little bit of a freaky wine. But in the end, it tastes exactly like the wines of the neighboring appellation of Pays-Sec-Léognan, right?
Did you know you nailed the blend?
Yeah, that's not that unusual.
I know, 50% Sauvignon Blanc, 50% Semillon. Yeah, this is a funky, really, really good wine.
Yeah, super cool stuff. I love it.
By the way, thank you for going through the tasting. Like, I hope people listening, like the hardcores, they're loving all of that. If you're newbies, I hope you enjoy it because that entire time, it was about actually 5-6 minutes.
I promised you it'd be quick.
I didn't waffle on. I totally geek out on that kind of stuff. So I love listening to that. I love listening to your notes. You know, the stewed grass makes so much more sense when you try it. I know for people new, they're like, what the bleep is he talking about? But it's all there.
Doesn't everyone have grass on their stovetop?
Of course. The tangerine. Like, yeah, absolutely. And on a blind, like, this one would mess me up if I had no idea, just on a blind taste. Like, I think I I'd go old world. I'd get somewhere there, and then I don't know. I might get tripped up. No.
Yeah, it's well, blind tasting's weird that way, right? Like you know, if you just get in the ballpark, you're winning, right?
Yeah.
And it's not a wine that's on people's radar, right?
No.
Even if it was the more classic Pessac Lignon, it's still. When do we ever see that? When was the last time you drank a bottle of Pessac Lignon? It's not on everyone's Wednesday night drink list.
Yep.
Smart stuff though. Great stuff. And in its own way, super distinctive.
Before we go, do you remember the name of this podcast?
Oh, Jesus. Matt talks about wine with really interesting people.
You know what? If you're in the ballpark, that's good enough. Matt talks wine and stuff with interesting people.
Oh, man.
He was so close. Yeah. Hey, Bruce, before we go, just give people Twitter, Instagram, email, website for the Somm Factory. Where can they get more information to see if at the very least they want to dip their toes? I highly recommend it.
Thank you.
You know, and the thing is, you can just, and like Bruce is one of the smartest people I've ever met in this industry. I mean, I think you can tell by this interview just the level of knowledge, but also just relaxed, not intimidating, and it's also fun. And I highly recommend it if you want to learn a little bit about wine, because not just only about wine, you're going to learn about geography, and you're going to learn about the law, and you're going to learn about, you know, all of these other things that you don't realize. It's not just about hot tannin talk. It's much more than that. So where can people get, where can they get more information?
Well, our Instagram. Well, my Instagram is at Master Somm, which I don't know. You could almost guess that. Our Instagram for work is at Somm Factory, also very guessable.
And which is a good thing. You want it to be guessable. Yeah. You don't want it to be long and clunky. That's a disaster.
Yeah, for sure. SommFactory.com is the website. Mind you, I think if you put MasterSomm.com, I think you get to the same website. Quite honestly. And our email is sommelierfactory, like the full word, sommelierfactory@gmail.com.
Sommelierfactory@gmail.com.
And you'll end up chatting with a lovely woman named Emily McLean, and she will lead you through all the steps necessary. She's really fantastic.
I met her today. She couldn't have been more polite. Yeah.
She's our director of operations, and she's just the friendliest person you imagine. Well, she's from the East Coast.
Yeah.
They're all like that over there.
Yeah. Imagine being the one mean person in the East Coast. Yeah. They must really stand out.
Yeah.
Hey, Bruce, really appreciate you. Really appreciate you joining me.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. This means a lot.
Matt's been great.
Yeah. So for everyone, thank you for listening again. Stitcher, Audio Boom, Apple iTunes is where you can get it. If you like the podcast, tell your friends who want to learn more about wine. If you didn't like the podcast, well, you know, my name's Levy Dalton. Take care and happy hunting.